Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Let me just give you a thumbnail sketch of Book Picks 2025. So the first Book Picks we had one bookseller on, and then the phone gave out. So then for second Book Picks, we had that same bookseller back to make good on what happened in the disaster of the first one. And now we're back to what I would say is the normal, which is to have two wonderful booksellers here at the table telling us about these incredible books that have hit store shelves. Let me introduce these booksellers to you. Cheryl McKeon is with us. She is from the Bookhouse in Albany, New York, as well as Market Block Books in Troy. Good morning, Cheryl. How are you?
Good morning. Happy to be here, Joe. Thank you.
Very nice to have you here. Jess Hunsaker is from North Shire Bookstore. They're located in Saratoga Springs, New York, and Manchester Center, Vermont. And good morning, Jess. How are you?
Doing very well. Good morning.
Wonderful to have you aboard. All right, Cheryl, where would you like to begin?
Well, on this very, very cold day, I'm going to start with The Heart of Winter.
All right.
This pubbed about a month ago by Jonathan Evason. And The Heart of Winter is a life-affirming love letter to family and long-term relationships. We meet Abe and Ruth Winter in 2023. They're settled into their empty nest in their home on Bainbridge Island, which is across from Seattle. It's Abe's 90th birthday, and all the kids are coming home. Evason then really smoothly moves us back to 1953 at the University of Washington and Abe and Ruth's first date. And Evason does this throughout the novel. He seamlessly alternates between time periods, and we feel like we're kind of maybe flipping through the family albums because it doesn't feel like there's a disruption as we go from present to past. And this builds our attachment to Abe and Ruth. They navigate the life they share and the tumultuous social changes they face through those decades. They have disagreed about politics and culture from the get-go, but they're navigating parenthood, Abe's tendency to overachieve in his insurance sales job, and Ruth's melancholy over missing a life of culture and experiences beyond being a mother and a housewife. They're really good people. They're loyal to each other. They're dedicated to their vows and the lives they committed to back in 1953. It's heartwarming. It's moving. The Heart of Winter is a reminder that true love lives in small, everyday moments. This is Jonathan Evason's 9th novel. He's really prolific. I've always enjoyed his work, but I think unfairly he might be best known for Lawn Boy, which was an innocuous coming-of-age story targeted by book banners in 2021. So if you wonder where you heard of Jonathan Evason, it might have been there. But please do pick up his other novels, especially The Heart of Winter.
The Heart of Winter by Jonathan Evason, published by Dutton. All right.
That sounds very interesting. Well, I'm going to kick us off with my list with a favorite read of mine from 2024. I feel like that feels appropriate heading into the new year. I had to reflect on this and really think about because there were so many excellent reads. But this one is the top of my list. It's The Impusium by Olga Tokarczuk. I absolutely adore her as a writer. I think that she might actually be one of my favorite writers ever, if I dare say that. And her previous book, Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead, is a real book club book at the moment, and I haven't read it myself. So actually on my way here, I was listening to the audiobook in the car and I'm completely hooked. But anyways, The Impusium, it focuses on this prolonged stay at a health resort. It's set in the Silesian Mountains on the eve of World War I. And you would think that perhaps staying at a health resort would be like a pretty restorative experience, but it really is actually anything but for our protagonist, who in the novel itself says he has a very unpronounceable name, so I won't even attempt to pronounce it. It's very Polish. He's afflicted with tuberculosis, so he has to put his engineering studies and his beekeeping hobby on hold, and he admits himself to the sanatorium for treatment. And like succumbing to consumption in this world, it's a complete inevitability. It looms overhead over this picturesque mountainside community, and everyone within is very affected by this. And as soon as he arrives, it really seems like the fabric of society there just completely unravels. And it's just an incredible searing take on gender politics and misogyny. It at times is extremely funny. It's dark. It's just beautifully written. It's so well translated by Antonia Lloyd-Jones. Everything that they work on together is just absolutely incredible. I had to like savor every page of this book.
That's great. It's so cool to have a favorite writer. That's very, very cool. All right. Thank you. Cheryl, you're up.
Women Talking by Miriam Taves is my next pick. Canadian author Miriam Taves begins her seventh novel with a note. What you are about to read is both based on a true story and an act of female imagination. The facts are that between 2005 and 2009, in a remote Mennonite colony of Canadian emigres in Bolivia, hundreds of girls and women were attacked in their sleep, anesthetized, and abused. Ghosts and demons were blamed, and eventually 8 men from the colony were found guilty of the assaults. The novel imagines 8 women of Malachna, which was the name of the community, maximizing the few days when the men are in the city. They're working for the release of the arrested attackers. The women have been kept illiterate, they can't speak the local language, and they want to keep their children safe, and they want to be free to think. In a tragically relevant yet wryly humorous novel, Miriam Taves has a fantastic dry sense of humor, so even in this setting, she finds things to laugh about. The eponymous women talking are discussing 3 options for their futures. Do nothing, number 1. Number 2, stay and fight. Or number 3, leave. As they're having these discussions, a man, a teacher who has been determined by the other men in the community not to be a threat, is taking notes, which really also adds to the humor of the story. So much to talk about, so much to think about in Women Talking. We have selected it for our March 3rd Bookhouse Book Club, and call if you'd like to join us.
Women Talking by Miriam Taves. All right. Jess.
Women Talking has been on my list for a little while. I feel very inspired. So I'm going to take a little detour on my list from historical fiction to just history with The Memory Palace, True Short Stories of the Past by Nate DiMeo. And some of you might find that a familiar name because obviously if you're listening to this, you like to listen to things. And there's a podcast by the very same name. So this book is so fun. It presents us with questions like, what do the Flying Walendas, acrobatic troupe, William Mumler's spirit photography, and Baby Ruth candy bars all have in common? Not really anything, actually, at all, other than the histories of all of those things are a little bit lost to time, and they've really taken Nate DiMeo, in stride. He's very interested in exploring the pasts of all these things. They provoked his imagination and his interest, and so he starts to string them together in this really fascinating curation of bite-sized histories. They're really united by nothing other than their capacity to create a sense of wonder. It's a very unique book. I kind of think of it like a box of chocolates. Every single little story is very like delectable, and you can just kind of take it in and enjoy it at your own pace. So I think it's a great pick for anyone who's just like a history enthusiast in general, aside from just fans of the podcast.
Very cool. The name is The Memory Palace, True Stories of the Past by Nate DiMeo. All right, Cheryl.
The Three Lives of Kate Kay by Kate Fagan is a fictional memoir supposedly written by a wildly successful author who does not exist. Kay is a pen name. The third persona adopted by the girl once known as Anna Callahan, and Anna Callahan was from Bolton Landing. So there's a real sense of a local flavor here for those of us in the Capital District. It's Kate Fagan's debut novel, and it's the story of a woman seeking to know herself. It explores themes of friendship, romance, intimacy, coming of age, coming out, ambition, mother-daughter relationships. And the narrative form is a captivating, heartfelt one. And the novel bursts at the seams with love in all its incredible, messy forms. It's a fascinating book in that one really has to kind of keep focused on which iteration of the protagonist, the narrator, were with, and how she's feeling. It's very evocative of the emotions, and we really do come to care about her and wonder how she is going to resolve this situation of finding herself. Kate Fagan, although this is her debut novel, she's been a sports writer for ESPN. She's written four other books, including What Made Maddie Run, which was a semi-finalist for the Penn ESPN Award for Literary Sports Writing. I read it, and I also listened to it. It's an excellent Libro FM. There are 12 voice actors, which really serves book very well.
I love that.
Kate Fagan is the author, or as we say in the States, author, The Three Lives of Kate Kay. All right. Excellent. Jess.
All right. Next up for me is Good Girl by Aria Aber. Now, this is a very salient debut. I think it's perfect for fans of Kaveh Akbar. If you liked Martyr, you're going to really like this book. So we follow Neela. She's a young Muslim artist born and raised in Berlin. And like the feeling of the city comes through in her writing so well. Like there's such a sense of place that comes from this book. But we follow her on this coming of age journey where she really attempts to reconcile what it means to be a good girl within the context of like her heritage, her Afghan heritage, and also in this like circle of people that she's found herself within socially. She's really trying to find her place as an artist and as a young woman. And it's just, it's at times like you kind of want to like shake her, like, Neela, what are you doing with your life? But you always root for her. And it's just such a shocking and startling piece of debut fiction that makes me like go, I can't believe this is her first novel. But she's incredible, and she has a Vermont connection, so anyone listening that is familiar with our Manchester store, our Vermont people, this one is going to be one you want on your radar.
Excellent. Good Girl is the name of the book. All right.
My next one is going to be released on February 11th, so it's right around the corner, and that is The Queens of Crime by Marie Benedict. It's a page-turner of a mystery and a story of women's friendship. The Golden Age of Mystery Writing group in 1931 in England included five women. The narrator is Dorothy Sayers. Anybody who reads mysteries would know Dorothy Sayers. And four of her colleagues also make up the Queens of Crime. Agatha Christie is one, and Agatha Christie was both a friend and a rival to Sayers. So Marie Benedict really captures that flavor of friendships that also go deeper than the surface, than just protagonists in a book. Their task here is to confront the chauvinism of male authors. They do so by proving their skills by solving a real-life murder. Dorothy Sayers did actually found the Detection Club for Mystery Writers in 1931 because all mystery writers were facing the disrespect of other authors who didn't think that they were real writers. So she founded the Detection Club, and all was well, except that the men in the club announced that there was an abundance of women. There were five, and they objected to that as part of their club. So then the women got together and decided they were going to fight this, and lo and behold, there was a mystery which had been unsolved, and they determined that they were going to figure out what happened. The mystery also represented chauvinism of the time because it was a young woman and the crime of her murder had just been kind of closed. Oh, well. And they did research and they did find out who did it. And they did eventually, not to spoil the ending, gain the respect of the other members of the Detection Club. And what I really love about Marie Benedict and her writing is that she does such excellent research, and you know that what she is presenting is accurate because she has researched it. She also incorporates a real feel for the era, and the era of the 1930s in England was wonderfully represented here with food and drink and clothing. It was great fun. Her other books that you might have heard of include Her Hidden Genius about Rosalind Franklin, mm-hmm. who discovered DNA, but her results were claimed by the male scientists. The Other Einstein, there was another Einstein, Albert's wife, who was also a talented physicist. And The Only Woman in the Room, 40s film star Hedy Lamarr, who was also a brilliant scientist.
The Queens of Crime by Marie Benedict. I'm such a fan of Ward Peter Wimsey and Dorothy Sayers. Those are great novels. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I read them recently thinking they wouldn't be, like maybe they had gotten old and stale, but no, they're still great.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Good stuff.
Love it.
Next up.
All right. Next is Andromeda by Therese Bowman. So this book is about a young intern who works her way up the corporate ladder at the most prestigious publishing imprint in Sweden, which is called Andromeda. And she finds herself entangled in a relationship with her boss with lines that are so blurred that neither of them really knows how to define it. It's an erudite and a very subversive take on the very real experiences that many women have entering and advancing in male-dominated industries. And it just captures the unique dynamic that can occur between two people who are actually very similar individuals, but who come from and live within two vastly different worlds. I think it's an excellent introduction to Scandinavian literature for the uninitiated, which was me. And I'm very excited now to dive into Bowman's earlier work.
Good stuff. So it is, again, Therese Bowman, Andromeda. All right. We've got about 10 minutes, so we're doing all right.
Okay.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
I would like to present Every Tom, Dick, and Harry by Eleanor Lippman. This also publishes February 11th. And if you have read Eleanor Lippman, her 15 previous novels, you kind of know what to expect. She reliably plots a madcap, smart foray into love and misadventure. She does this by building a hilarious plot on an unlikely premise. This time, a recent liberal arts graduate has been convinced by her parents to take over their estate sale business. Things aren't going so well in the publishing industry, so she does move home and takes over the estate sale business. Her first client looks really good. She's emptying her elegant B&B on the town's most prestigious street, only it turns out that one of the B's stands for brothel. So the young woman has to deal with the small town setting. It's Harlow, Massachusetts, an imaginary little town. It invites coincidences and many revelations of local secrets. There is, of course, a love story because the new chief of police happens to be her age. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And went to the same high school. As always, Eleanor welcomes us to a world of likable characters playing the hands they're dealt and nefarious ones earning their just rewards. You know you're headed for a happy ending, but the road is full of plot twists and laugh-out-loud dialogue. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry is set in Western Massachusetts, and Eleanor will be reading at Odyssey Books in South Hadley on Wednesday, February 19th at 7.
Excellent. Ooh. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry by Eleanor Lippman. All right.
Sounds like so much fun. I have one that's not so much fun. Beta Vulgaris by Margie Sarsfield is my next book. So it follows two young people, they're a couple, who go to Minnesota to work a sugar beet harvest so that they can afford to pay their rent for this apartment in Brooklyn that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And if that sounds pretty bad, it gets worse from there. The rest of the book is dotted by missing persons cases and potentially even sentient beets. It's really very surreal. It's, I think, a breakout debut, perfect for fans of Mona Awad. It serves what really is like a brutal and genuinely sometimes very stomach-churning type of horror. It has this really chilling commentary on the follies of youth, on debt and labor. It goes really into industrial agriculture, actually, which might feel like something you wouldn't see in a horror title, but like is like the whole point of this book, perhaps. Either way, it's a reminder that in the end, we all return to the dirt. I thought it was very spooky, especially when I learned that this author actually herself was inspired to write this because she worked on a sugar beet farm. And that makes me really question what exactly that might be like, because it was an extremely surreal experience from the first page until the last. I hope she's okay.
Yeah. Margie. Hope she didn't return to the dirt.
Yeah.
Beta Vulgaris is the name of the book. All right, Cheryl.
Well, my next book is a little foodie as well. It isn't sugar beets, but it's saffron. And the name of the book is Love and Saffron by Kim Fay. I resurrected this. It came out in 2021, I think. In response to those who are asking for something happy, I want a happy book. I want something that isn't sad. I don't want it to be fluffy. I want it to be well written, but I want it to make me feel good. Mm-hmm. So Love and Saffron does fit the bill. It is an epistolary novel. I personally have loved epistolary novels as long as I can remember. Mm-hmm. And this time it's letters between a young woman, 26, who lives in L.A., and she writes a fan letter to a food writer in the Pacific Northwest who lives in an island off of Seattle. Imogene is 59. Joan, as I said, is 26. But Imogene, as a food writer, has written about all of the clams that are plentiful around her home. And when Joan reads this in the more sophisticated city of L.A., she sends her a packet of saffron and suggests she try this with her clams. Thus begins a decades-long friendship between the women, which, although they do eventually meet, is primarily through letters. They support each other through the vagaries of life, also through the social crises of that era, of the 1960s, and you really come to appreciate and love the idea of a friendship through letters, a friendship through food, and it kind of reinforces the patience of not having email or telephone or texting and writing a letter and waiting for the response, and how that kind of enhances the idea of how much a friendship can mean.
Nice and happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. above all, happy. All right. We probably have a book each, I think, a time for.
Okay. Ooh. All right. I will pick Optional Practical Training by Shubha Sundar as my potentially last book. So we follow, maybe I could go fast, we'll see. Pavitra, she's originally from India. She's now residing in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's just begun her period of optional practical training, which is 12 months at the end of a student visa that can enable immigrants to stay in the United States to work. It's so tenderly written. It's a very insightful story that chronicles, again, another young woman's journey as an immigrant. Although this, of course, is set in America and it's post 9/11. And she encounters every single ism one could think of. It's really pretty stark. And again, a story where you're just consistently rooting for this protagonist. And she, too, is an artist, very similar to Neela in Good Girl. She's a writer, and she really is trying to carve out this niche for herself. She's trying to become her own person. She's finding her place in the world. And unlike Good Girl, which is very much like kind of nightlife focused, this is like a breath of fresh air. It really is just so sweet and so wonderful. I'm very excited to say that we're hosting Shubha at our Booktopia Festival this spring. I think this is the first time that we've announced any of our authors that will be in that lineup. So everyone listening is getting a little teaser of what to expect.
A little preview. Yeah. Excellent. Good stuff. All right. Finally, we've got about 45 seconds.
Okay. Ooh. It's a long title. I may not get past it. Dear Miss Perkins, the story of Frances Perkins' efforts to aid refugees from Nazi Germany, by Rebecca Brenner Graham. Frances Perkins has regional as well as national significance. She was the first female member of New York Governor Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet, managing his labor department just after the crash of 1929. Then when he was elected president, he named her the first woman to serve in a presidential cabinet. She was Secretary of Labor. The fellows didn't know what to call her. Somebody suggested the madam, but eventually it became Madam Secretary, and she was the first one. It's a deeply researched book, but it reads like a novel. It just moves so quickly. And it's one of those books where you want to say to the person next to you, did you know Frances Perkins? Did you know the Department of Labor? Did you know the immigration laws? There's so much history in here and a wonderful picture of Frances Perkins herself.
Wow. Dear Miss Perkins is the name of the book. For more information about all of these wonderful books, you can go to their websites, northshire.com and bhny.com. All of our book pick lists are posted online, wamc.org/roundtable. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.